Jerusalem, our feet are standing in your gates, oh Jerusalem. Our hands are raised in praise to the God of Abraham.
Isaac. Welcome to Jerusalem Next. I'm Kimberly Rogers Brown, and this week, Russia and the United States ratcheted up their animosity in Syria and the Baltic Sea. The Trump investigation now seems poised to engulf John McCain. The economy is, well, not well. But first, two developing red war fronts. The U.S. military said a Navy fighter jet shot down a Syrian warplane this week after the Syrian jet dropped bombs near Syrian Democratic Forces, or the SDF, fighters on Sunday. This was the first time the U.S. military shot down a Syrian aircraft since it began fighting ISIS in 2014. The shootdown came a little more than 2 hours after forces allied with the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad attacked the north-central Syrian town of Jenin, which was controlled by the SDF. A number of U.S.-backed SDF forces were wounded in the Syrian government's attack. The U.S.-led coalition issued a statement that said, in accordance with rules of engagement and in collective self-defense of coalition-partnered forces, the Syrian jet was immediately shot down by a U.S. F/A-18E Super Hornet. The coalition statement further said the U.S. military's actions demonstrated hostile intent toward coalition and allied forces in Syria, conducting legitimate counter-ISIS operations, and that such actions will not be tolerated. The Syrian military called the action a flagrant aggression that affirmed the United States' real stance is in support of terrorism. The statement said the attack stresses coordination between the U.S. and ISIS, and it reveals the evil intentions of the U.S. in administering terrorism and investing in it to further the U.S. Zionist project in the region. Russia also slammed the downing of the Syrian fighter jet by the U.S. Russia claims this is the first such escalation since the start of the conflict in 2011. CENTCOM said the shootdown was in defense of partners from the Syrian Democratic Forces. But Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov declared the attack as an aggression, an act of aggression, and assistance for terrorists that the U.S. says it is fighting against. Russia further asked, what is it then, if not an act of aggression, an act directly in breach of international law? Assad's attack drove the SDF from Jenin, which is west of Raqqa, and later a Syrian government Su-22 again attacked the SDF forces with bombs. A day after a U.S. Navy fighter shot down the Syrian warplane, Russia warned that aircraft operating where the shootdown occurred would be considered air targets for its forces in Syria. Russia has stopped using a key deconfliction communication channel set up to avoid conflict between U.S. and Russian forces in Syria. The U.S. is now working diplomatically and militarily to reestablish that deconfliction channel. Russia said from now on, in areas where Russian aviation performs combat missions in the skies of Syria, any airborne objects found west of the Euphrates River, including aircraft and unmanned vehicles belonging to the international coalition, tracked by means of Russian land and air anti-aircraft defense, will be considered air targets. This is according to the Russian Defense Ministry. And Russia also warned the U.S. to not strike Syrian government troops again. Last week, the U.S. deployed the HIMARS multiple rocket launchers in southern Syria. The U.S. military moved the new truck-mounted long-range rocket launcher from Jordan
to a U.S. base in Al-Tanf, Syria, near the Iraqi and Jordanian borders, stepping up its presence in that area. They said the high-mobility artillery rocket systems, or HIMARS, had moved into the desert garrison, which has been building up in recent weeks because tensions escalated after the U.S.-led coalition struck Iranian-backed forces to prevent them from advancing toward the Al-Tanf base, which is held by the United States. Washington deployed the HIMARS on the Turkish border to strike at ISIS outposts, and they were used several times from the Jordanian border to hit militants who had a foothold in the southeastern desert. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said last week that the HIMARS might be intended for another purpose, which is to cut off Syrian government troops from allies in Iraq, since there are no Islamic State militants in the region to target with the weapons. HIMARS was not used in the shootdown of the Syrian warplane. Now, ISIS is significantly weakened, according to analysts who believe that all parties in Syria are maneuvering to consolidate their positions for an eventual settlement of the conflict. Jeremy Binney, Middle East and African editor for Jane Defense Weekly, says the players in Syria are now operating with half an eye on the post-Islamic State situation and looking to control as much territory as possible. Russia could work to de-escalate the situation, he said, but Moscow is looking increasingly less like an honest mediator between the sides. He said, "We don't know until we see how it plays out in reality, but it is definitely Russia making a pretty strong statement in favor of the Assad government." Dmitry Trenin, who is the director of the Carnegie Moscow Center, said the events of Sunday and Monday are a significant escalation, which could result in a collision between the two sides. To defuse the situation, he recommends that the U.S. begin to see Russia as a more equal partner in determining the future of Syria. And in Iraq, the Pentagon said an American F-15E fighter jet shot down an Iranian-made armed drone that was flying toward American-backed Syrian fighters and their advisors on Tuesday. The F-15E intercepted the drone and tried to get it to change course, but it continued to fly toward the fighters, who were at a combat outpost with their advisors northeast of the town of Al-Tanf, where the U.S. military base is located. The drone was shot down shortly after midnight local time. The shootdown over southeast Syria was a fresh indication that the air war between forces supporting President Bashar al-Assad of Syria and the American military is likely to continue and perhaps escalate, even though the United States has sought to keep its focus on defeating the Islamic State militants operating in Syria and Iraq. American officials said the downed aircraft was a Shahed 129, the same type of drone that an American warplane blasted on June 8th after the drone dropped a bomb near American-supported Syrian fighters and their coalition advisors at the same location. American officials said they did not know whether Shiite militia fighters, Syrian officers, or Iranian advisors were operating the drones. Now let's turn our attention to the Baltic Sea, where Russia is becoming more aggressive as time moves on. This week, an armed Russian fighter jet buzzed an American aircraft, coming within 5 feet. The incident happened over the Baltic Sea on Monday morning as an American RC-135 reconnaissance aircraft flew in international airspace. The plane was flying with its transponder on, making it identifiable to other aircraft. The Russian Defense Ministry accused the RC-135 of performing provocative maneuvers toward the Russian fighter. The American pilot reported that the Russian fighter approached the wingtip of the RC-135 before passing underneath it and reappearing by the opposite wing. Now let's turn our attention to the Trump-Russia election investigation. Another twist in the investigation came to light this week about the relationship between President Donald Trump and the Russians. The Democratic-run investigation of Trump's election team and Trump himself is turning into a witch hunt. A new proposal by an anti-Trump Democrat on the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, would expand the federal government's probe into the alleged Russian influence to foreign companies and internet sites that take political ads, companies and websites like Facebook or the Drudge Report, while giving the FEC an unprecedented role that some say oversteps its authority. Democratic Commissioner Ellen Weintraub cited petitions from leftist groups demanding a wider investigation. On Thursday, her plans were announced to push for Election Commission support of her idea. And at a meeting of the election committee on Thursday, she called this an all-hands-on-deck moment for our democracy and appealed to the commission to consider the wider investigation. In her new proposal, Weintraub goes much further than earlier concerns about corporations and internet sites, but she offered no evidence of interference other than news reports and two petitions from leftist groups at the meeting. Weintraub is urging the FEC to investigate political spending by foreign sources on the internet, including Facebook that I mentioned earlier, and presumably any other site that runs political ads, again, like the Drudge Report and Huffington Post. As part of that, she called for an open and closed-door briefing by Justice and Treasury financial officials on the issue. But this is not the only place where this investigation is going. John McCain now seems to be involved. Not only is the investigation spreading into agencies and public alternative news sites and social media, both of which the Dems want to control or shut down, but now the investigation may include John McCain. It is being claimed that the same foreign lobbyists and Russians tied to the Trump probe were once associated to Senator John McCain when he ran for president. McCain's drama involves the same foreign lobbyist Paul Manafort, one of the same Russian oligarchs Oleg Deripaska, the same Russian diplomat Sergei Kislyak, and the Russian leader Vladimir Putin himself that now dominate the current Trump controversy. The FBI has said that there is no evidence to date that Trump ever met with a foreign Russian figure banned from the United States, but McCain apparently did. McCain actually met twice with Deripaska, a Russian businessman and Putin ally, whose visa was blocked by the United States amid intelligence community concern about his ties to Moscow. The meetings were arranged by Manafort and his lobbying firm partner, Rick Davis, who later would become McCain's campaign manager, according to interviews and documents. Deripaska, a metals magnate, is president of the United Company Rusal and is considered to be one of the richest men in the world, worth an estimated $5.1 billion, according to Forbes. During the 2008 campaign, the Davis-Manafort firm disclosed through its U.S. partner Daniel J. Edelman Incorporated that it was working for the political party in Ukraine, supporting Ukrainian Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych, who was backed by Putin. Davis Manafort International LLC is directed by a foreign political party, the Ukraine Parties of Regions, to consult on the political campaign in Ukraine in the January 28 Foreign Agent Registration Act filing. The work included developing a communications campaign to increase Prime Minister Yanukovych's visibility in the U.S. and Europe, the report added, indicating that Davis and Manafort were being paid a $35,000 a month retainer for the work that began in the spring of 2007. Davis Manafort would have been lobbying for a different outcome for Ukraine than the one they got by Obama's meddling in their election process. McCain's office also was warned by U.S. intelligence about possible Russian military connections to one of his policy advisors at the IRI, causing aides to scramble to separate the Russian-born expert from the U.S. senator, according to U.S. officials and McCain aides. Manafort was first questioned by the FBI about his Russian and Ukrainian ties in 2014, 2 years before he became Trump's campaign manager, and agents probed him on how he first came to work for Deripaska through McCain's top political advisor. The McCain story also is a poignant reminder that Putin's allies have long sought U.S. political influence and that U.S. counterintelligence often focuses on keeping Americans from becoming compromised by foreigners. Now let's take a look at what's going on here with this Russian intervention and this statement that U.S. counterintelligence focuses on keeping Americans from becoming compromised by foreigners. The Russians claimed during Eisenhower's presidency that they would destroy the United States from within. They have been meddling in our affairs just as much as we have meddled in theirs. U.S. meddling in foreign elections is not only okay, but heralded as necessary to ensure fair elections in other countries. But meddling in the U.S. elections is decried as unfair if the wrong candidate wins. No one has considered addressing the foreign lobbyists and financial contributors to the Obama campaign, those being of the Islamic stripe, those who wanted to use the American White House to establish a means for settling the Sunni-Shiite sectarian issue. No one has suggested that Obama be put on trial for all the treason he committed against the U.S. Constitution and the American people during his too long and usurped and illegal reign in the White House. Apparently, foreign interference is okay as long as it results in a democratic destroyer of democracy usurping the White House. But if a Republican constitutionalist and upholder of freedoms for the American people take office, it is a different story. It depends on whether the people complaining about this are red communist or red religious types or blue-colored House of Jacob descendants and friends. Now let's turn our attention to the activities of ISIS. As the Islamic State loses territory in Iraq and Syria, fears mount that the militant group is gaining a stronghold in the Philippines and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. The Philippines has become the epicenter for the Islamic State, or ISIS, as it expands into the region where more than 60 groups have pledged allegiance to ISIS, according to the Singapore-based International Center for Political Violence and Terrorism Research. The Philippines has become a destination for militants from around the region, analysts say, especially after ISIS released a video in June of 2016 advising potential recruits to head for Mindanao in the Philippines if they couldn't make it to Syria or Iraq. Dozens of foreigners have been fighting alongside the Filipino militants in Marawi, with several Malaysians and Indonesians, as well as a Chechen Remember the Boston Marathon bombing? There are fighters also from Yemeni and Saudi Arabia among those who have been reported killed. ISIS has been clear about its intentions to turn to Southeast Asia as one of its major sites for operations, drawing recruits from the Philippines and the Muslim-majority countries of Indonesia and Malaysia. The drawn-out siege by militants in the city of Marawi is exposing the vulnerability of the Philippine military, which could undermine that region's security, according to analysts. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte declared martial law on May 24th in Mindanao, the southern island where Marawi is located, citing the rising threat of ISIS on the island. About 500 militants have seized large parts of Marawi while burning buildings, cutting power and communication lines, and taking hostages. The U.S. Embassy in Manila acknowledged last Saturday that U.S. Special Forces are assisting the Philippine military in the ongoing fight to retake Marawi. The U.S. help was limited to surveillance and technical support, according to the Philippine military. Marawi is a game-changer in the fight against terrorism in the Philippines. Rohan Gonaratna, head of the International Center for Political Violence and Terrorism Research, says ISIS' presence there demonstrates to all countries in the region what ISIS can do. They never thought what happened in the Middle East could happen in Asia, he said. Jihadists seized the Malagakit Elementary School in the town of Picawayan in southern Philippines on Wednesday, holding 31 hostages, including students, for about 12 hours before escaping into a vast marshland area, the military said. The militants are from a splinter group called the Bangsamoro Islamic Freedom Fighters, or BIFF, that pledged loyalty to ISIS in 2014. They took hostages, including 6 students, to prevent troops from advancing. 2 pro-government militiamen were wounded in the firefight, according to the military. The last standoff until sundown, according to Captain Encinas, added that the guerrillas eventually withdrew and released all the hostages. The conflict in Mindanao broke out on May 23rd when hundreds of militants went on a rampage in Marawi City after government forces attempted to arrest a local leader of the Islamic State terrorist movement. The military says the militants had planned the attacks months ahead and intended to burn down Marawi City and set up an Islamic State caliphate in that southern region of Mindanao. President Duterte declared martial law in Mindanao to boost the fight against the rebels, giving the military control of the affected areas and allowing soldiers to arrest suspects without court warrants. The fighting has left Marawi City in ruins, with houses and buildings torched by the militants or destroyed by the military's airstrikes. Streets are littered with crushed cement, twisted steel, abandoned vehicles, and decomposing bodies, according to fleeing civilians. More than 300 people have been killed in the fighting, including at least 257 militants, 58 government troops, and 29 civilians. More than 300,000 residents have also been displaced from Marawi City and nearby towns. The ISIS-linked militants still control parts of the central city and have as many as 2,000 hostages there, the military said. The enemy we face right now is a different breed, according to Brigadier General Restituto Padilla. They are practicing ultra-violent intimidations and are doing recruitment remotely through the internet and social media and what have you. If we do not work as a nation and band together to fight it, the threat might increase, he said. Analysts warned that the southern Philippines could become a hub for foreign terrorist fighters, making it extremely important for the military to neutralize the militants in Marawi City and their leader, Isnilon Hapalon. Stay tuned. I will be right back after these messages. Sits upon the throne of Jerusalem. Oh, Jerusalem, our feet are standing in your gate. Welcome back to Jerusalem Next. In this half hour, you will learn how Russia and ISIS are fulfilling Bible prophecy. The world is witnessing the rise of two red war fronts, working not with each other on the surface, but against each other, Russia and ISIS. Yahweh is throwing confusion into the red Edomite camp. These two players, who appear to be enemies on the surface, are actually fulfilling the scripture's prophecies without knowing they're doing so. This confirms that the heavenly host, led by Yahweh, is in control of these armies' activities. Both red groups descend from the ancestor Esau. The Bible is very clear in Genesis that Esau, Jacob's own twin brother and archenemy, is red, and that his territory, Edom, is also red. This is a sign for us in the end of days who understand to look for the activities of those who are red. The first group is the secular red nations that are spread throughout the earth. These are Russia, China, North Korea, and all their allies, including Iran, which is in the next group, the second religious group, which is also red. But communism is red. Russia, China, North Korea. They are red communists. These have the ongoing agenda to subdue the earth and all its people. The second group is the religious red. The secular red group, Russia, and the religious red group are tied together through Iran and Russia's alliance. These hide behind a green flag with a crescent moon. We know them by their ideology and activities. The most flagrant red group behind that green flag with the crescent moon is ISIS, who are the descendants of Amalek, the grandson of Esau. The Amalekites are the most vicious and underhanded descendants of Esau. Just read about them throughout the scriptures. Their most famous exploits have to do with the attack by the Amalekites on the children of Israel as they wandered weak and thirsty through the wilderness, and Haman of the Esther account. The red religious group also has the agenda to subdue the earth and all its people. They are working separately but closely allied between Russia and Iran, even though they're not aware of how they're being used by Yahweh in the end of days. The blessing that Isaac gave to Esau when Jacob received his blessing was one of struggle, ending in war between the two brothers. When Esau cried out to Isaac to bless him, Isaac said in Genesis 27:39 and 40, "Your dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and the dew of heaven from above, and by your sword you shall live and shall serve your brother. And it shall come to pass, when you shall have the dominion, that you shall break his yoke from off your neck." We are now in the time when Esau is breaking the yoke of Jacob from his neck. That is the reason for the coming great tribulation and the maneuvering that Yahweh is doing of the red secular and red religious Esau groups on the earth. Both red groups have differing ideologies, but they have the same agenda, which is to subdue and kill the descendants of Jacob wherever they are on the earth. And, as you know, we are everywhere now. Red Russia and its Asian allies are a known war machine, a known quantity that the United States and its allies are currently underestimating. ISIS is on the rise in the Middle East, in the Philippines, in Southeast Asia. They are spreading like ants. Bombing them does not work. They don't want control of just Syria and the Middle East. They want to establish a global caliphate, and their plan is to launch into the Western Jacobite nations from the Philippines. The former White House usurper Barack Obama created ISIS as his personal army with which he hoped to rule the earth. Yahweh has other plans. He intends to use ISIS and the communist nations to drive Jacob back to their rightful home in the Middle East, in Israel. As the red religious ISIS and other jihadists spread around the earth where Yahweh can easily destroy them, he is also beginning to call his people home. Some are hearing and heeding that call. Others, probably most, will have to be driven back under his wrath, as it says in Ezekiel 20. Now let's turn our attention to the economy. Tyler Durden wrote this in his ZeroHedge.com article on March 9, 2017, quote, "If you thought 2016 was weird, I suggest you get comfortable with the surreal, because it is not going away anytime soon. 2017 is a veritable treasure trove of falling elevators, and I haven't even covered half of the issues facing the economy this year. So what about the macro analysis?" he said. We're going to look at that macro analysis in a minute, but as he said, there is a lot of expectation for 2017, as there was in 2015 and 2016, about a coming economic collapse. Durden wrote in the same article, quote, "As I have always said, economic collapse is a process, not a singular moment in time. This process lulls the masses into complacency. You can show them warning sign after warning sign, but most of them have no concept of what a collapse is. They are waiting for a cinematic moment of revelation, a financial explosion, when really the whole disaster is happening in slow motion right under their noses. Economies do not explode. They drown as the water rises 1 inch at a time," he said. I agree. Rather than looking for a huge one-off economic collapse on the order of a sudden volcanic eruption, we should watch economic factors that can fall like dominoes one after the other. The problem is that today's economy is extremely difficult to predict because of the many unforeseen events, situations, and conditions that are now arising. Dave Hodges of the Common Sense Show says the U.S. economy is already in free flow. In international trade circles, everyone knows how much trouble the United States is in economically. We could look at debts, But in this presentation, we're going to look at international economic factors that could soon make it impossible to obtain basic supplies. In particular, I'm going to reference the Baltic Dry Index and the plunging oil prices. These two factors alone are wreaking havoc and devastation upon our economy, quote unquote. Unforeseen factors are wreaking more damage than anything else. Forbes magazine didn't know which way the economy would go in January 2017 when it said there is always the chance that some bolt from the blue could change everything. An international crisis, a large bank failure, terror attacks, any one of a long list of unforeseeable events could conceivably derail this train. And then they listed a few factors to watch. But before we go to those factors, let's take a look at what's happening in the state of Illinois. Illinois is like Venezuela now, a fiscally broken state that has lost its will to live, although for the moment they still have enough toilet paper. But not even the lottery is safe in Illinois. Illinois has finally run out of other people's money, you know, those people outside the state who have been funding Illinois in recent years. Facing billions in unpaid bills and pension obligations, Illinois is hitting a cash crunch that is rare even by Illinois standards. And now, Illinois faces doomsday. The state has not had a state budget for years, and lawmakers continue to spend money that they don't have. Governor Bruce Rauner said that we are like a banana republic. He said this after the General Assembly failed yet again to pass a budget package by the regular session deadline. He further said, "We can't manage our money," increasing the cost of borrowing more money they don't have. Moody's Investor Services this week said taxpayers are on the hook for $251 billion in unfunded public union pension liabilities. A top financial official just warned that 100% of the state's monthly revenue will now be eaten up by court-ordered payments. Court-ordered payments that the state of Illinois cannot make. The governor called for a special session this week starting on Wednesday. Both political parties blamed each other for the mess instead of working across the aisle for solutions, and they adjourned without making any substantial progress. Bipartisan meetings between the key political leaders have also been sparse. Nobody here in Illinois is considering bankruptcy. First of all, it's not allowed, said Steve Brown, press secretary for Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. Second of all, it would damage the reputation of the state, and it's just not necessary, he said. Illinois, which is in its third year without a budget, holds the title for longest state budget stalemate. No other state even comes close to Barack Obama's home state, Illinois. No other state comes close to this kind of budget stalemate and has the worst in the nation credit rating. But these economic troubles are not limited to America. This starts with America, but extends across the globe. China is also worried. It's worried about a global economic collapse. If the 1997 Asian financial crisis and the 2008 subprime mortgage crisis are anything to go by, then the next cataclysm will come as a result of inadequate risk prevention, swiftly followed by universal economic collapse and the resultant woes, according to a statement made in the Chinese press. So China is now focused on their financial system in order to prevent what could be an absolute catastrophe. And if you read between the lines, they are blaming the U.S. for these catastrophes. As China blames the U.S. for the planet's economic woes, they are teaming up with Russia militarily. The economy is already over the cliff and hanging by a twig. It won't take much for Russia and China to team up against the U.S. on its mainland, especially given how angry Russia is over U.S. recent shenanigans in Syria. So the economic factors that I want to turn our attention to are as follows. Number one, markets are far more volatile now in the wake of Brexit and Trump's election. Against all odds, the U.S. did elect Donald Trump, and no one can now predict how the next 4 years will go, and so far, it's not going that well. As a commander-in-chief, Trump now has the power to declare a nuclear war, and nobody can legally stop him. Britain is now trying to leave the EU, and other European countries are planning to follow their example. So no matter where you look in the Western world, uncertainty is in the air like never before. Number two, the U.S. government has its eye on retirement accounts. In 2010, Portugal seized retirement account assets to help plug holes with government deficits and debts. Ireland and France did the same thing in 2011, as did Poland in 2013. The U.S. government has been watching how that worked in Portugal, Ireland, France, and Poland to see whether it will be a good option for the United States. Since 2011, the Treasury has taken money from government workers' pension funds on four separate occasions to cover deficits in federal spending. Investing billionaire legend Jim Rogers believes that private accounts will be the next ones that the government raids. Number three, the top five U.S. banks are now larger than before the 2008 crisis. You learned about the five largest banks in the U.S. and their systemic importance as the unfolding financial crisis threatened to collapse them in 2008. Legislators and regulators then promised they would address this issue once that crisis was over. Well, all these years later, the five biggest banks are even bigger and more critical to the system than before the former crisis began. The government made the problem worse when it forced some of these so-called too-big-to-fail banks to absorb the failing ones. Any of these banking behemoths failing now would be absolutely catastrophic. Number four, danger from derivatives threatens the banks more now than in 2007 and 2008. The derivatives that crashed the banks back in 2008 did not disappear as regulators promised. Today, the derivatives exposure of the five biggest American banks is a whopping 45% greater than before the economic collapse of 2008. Today's derivative bubble is over $273 trillion now versus the $187 trillion in 2008. Number five, U.S. interest rates are already at abnormal lows, so the Fed has little room to cut rates. Even after raising interest rates once last year, the federal funds rate is still in the range of 0.25% to 0.5%. Consider that before the crisis erupted in August of 2007, the federal funds interest rate sat at 5.25%. In the next crisis, the Fed will have less than half a percentage point total in which it can reduce rates to stimulate the economy. Six, American banks are not the safest place for your money. Global Finance Magazine puts out a yearly list of the top 50 safest global banks. Only five of those are U.S.-based. The top spot is an American bank that is only number 39 on the list. Number 7. The Fed balance sheet is still expanded from the financial crisis of 2008. The Fed still has nearly $1.8 trillion in mortgage-backed securities on its balance sheet from the 2008 financial crisis. This is more than double the less than $1 trillion it held before the crisis began. When mortgage-backed securities go bad again, the Federal Reserve has a lot less maneuverability to absorb those bad assets than they did before. Number 8. The FDIC admits that it lacks reserves to cover another banking crisis. The latest FDIC's annual report shows that they will not have sufficient reserves to adequately insure the nation's banking deposits for minimally another 5 years. This stunning revelation admits that they can only cover 1% of U.S. bank-held deposits, or one out of every $100 of your bank account deposits. Number 9. Long-term unemployment is still higher than before the Great Recession. Unemployment was 4.4% in early 2007 before the last crisis began, while the unemployment rate finally reached the 4.7% level seen as the financial crisis began to ravage the U.S. economy. The long-term unemployment remains high, and the employment participation rate significantly is lower now than it was during that time. Number 10. American businesses are failing at a record pace. In the beginning of 2016, the Gallup CEO Jim Clifton announced that American business failures are now greater than new business startups for the first time in over 3 decades. The dearth of medium and small businesses has huge implications for an economy long driven by free enterprise, which was killed under Obama. Bigger businesses are not immune to the problems. Even American economic heavyweights like Microsoft, which has been reducing its jobs by the tune to 18,000, and McDonald's, that has been shutting down 700 stores since the past year, are suffering from this dismal trend. Economic collapse is coming, and I think what we're going to see first is a huge economic downturn like the one in 2008. It won't be a sudden economic volcanic eruption. Why do I say this? Well, I base this understanding on the book of Revelation that reveals that the end time collapse will happen during the period called the Great Tribulation. You can read about that in Revelation 6, 5 and 6, 6, and in Revelation 18, verses 2 to 18, verse 10. Read those scriptures for the description of how Babylon falls completely during the Great Tribulation. But her demise began in the decades before the Great Tribulation. However, her fall is a process that culminates during the Great Tribulation. Each time there is a downturn, a warning is given to leave Babylon. During the last event of the Great Tribulation, as spoken of in Revelation, it is war. It is the war in which she is burned when the final call is made for believers to escape. I believe these events will happen in close succession in the first few months of the Great Tribulation, but that is not September 2017. September 2017 will be just another process in the long drawn out processes Yahweh is using to bring Mystery Babylon to her knees. Remember, Jerusalem is our next destination. Shabbat Shalom.